is the role of Summer League? What are we trying to get accomplished now that's going to actually improve the game of basketball?
Rick Bucher. The value for me in Summer League is when you take these top talents, you take away the inherent physical advantage they have and the systems that they grew up in college.
This is the B.J. Armstrong and Rick Bucher Show, starring B.J. and Bucher.
Welcome to the latest edition of the BJ and Bucher podcast on the cycle. My name is Rick Bucher. He is BJ Armstrong, and we are now into NBA training camps. A lot going on in the sports world, but training camp is always an interesting time. And I'm curious, this is the first time we've been able to do this podcast while we are in training camp. So I want to avail myself of I actually allow people to hear what it's like for somebody from the media, myself, and somebody who's both played, been an executive, and served in the media, and is now an agent, BJ, to give us a view of what it's like. And this is what I'm really curious about for starters, which is, what is it like when you guys have practices right before the media come in? Like, how does it change once you have eyes that are outside the team? Like, I just wonder what the conversation is before we walk in and how different it is once the media is there.
All right, let's just get behind and pull the curtains back.
Yes, please.
I loved it when I saw the media. That meant practice was over. I mean, especially the morning session, right?
Right.
Like, when is the media coming in? Because that means practice is over. Right. That means there'll be no more coaches cursing you out. There'll be no more line drills. You know, the coaches are gonna, you know, be all nice. And right. Practice was over. It was right. All fluff. So it's free throws. There was a little water. There was a little hugging going on. Coach is telling everybody how great a job he was. So we were like, hey,
yeah.
Preseason is the one time where you love the media, because wherever they're around, that means it's over. So be honest with you, I love the media, because I mean, like, everything was over with. I mean, practice was done.
So how different was it? Like, I always think about the coaches and the way they'd address the media and how we'd see them. And then I just know that, like, there was some famous guy, like PJ Carlissimo was always the ultimate diplomat in front of the microphone and with the media and everything. And then I heard he was just like, he was a rat bastard when it came, like, in practice. He was constantly on guys. I mean, he was just, there's a reason why Latrell Sprewell tried to strangle him.
Did you just say that, Rick? You just said that, did you?
I did. So that's my question, which is, like, how different the coaches, and you played mostly for Phil, but not exclusively for
right,
Phil.
Right.
What was it like? Like, how different were the coaches in practice, the conversation, the way they addressed players in practice versus what we would see with the media?
With no disrespect to anyone, all the coaches that I played for and all the organizations, all the good teams that I played for, when I say good teams, the teams that were we expected to win, where we had actually felt like every night we were going to go out there and compete and go to win. Not to say that we didn't on the other teams, but, you know, there's just this feeling that you have, you have with a group of guys when you know every night we have a chance. The coaches coach during practice. That was their game, practice. They coach really hard in practice. The game was yours. And it was, and I didn't learn that until I got traded from the Bulls. So Phil Jackson would practice. His game was practice. That was his game. He was turned on. Every mistake I made in practice had a consequence to it. You know, if I made a chest pass and I was supposed to do a bounce pass, I had to rewind and do the exact, I had to be perfect in practice. What I learned once I was traded from that was when the lights came on, some of those coaches started coaching once the media got in the
right.
Once the media started coming in, putting the lights on, and they turned up and it was like, huh? What's going on here?
Yeah.
Because when you have a chance to win, you're actually trying to hide and disguise what you're doing in the game so that the team can't prepare for it.
Right.
The other teams, it's almost like a show.
Yeah.
You know, when the lights come on, you see coaches turn on, you see players turn on, everyone's looking for the lights. Where we were like, oh, okay, we want to undersell, like we're not really practicing. We want it to look unorganized. So when the game came about, you know, that you guys practice now, we just kind of, you know,
yeah.
It was like,
yeah, the little okey doke.
Yeah, you wanted to undersell. But when I was on the other end, I learned that everyone was trying to impress once the lights and the media came in and make it look bigger and better than what it really was.
So was that something that was said? Like, was that something that was discussed about how you were going to approach once the media came in? Because I always, like, I had the same feeling. I'd walk in and I'd go, okay, this isn't real practice. And they don't really want to show us anything. And I have covered the league long enough that there was a time where we were allowed to watch practice. I mean, I would, like, when I covered the Warriors, when I first came into the league and Nelly ran practice, we got a chance to watch a good part of practice, and it actually was beneficial for us.
Well, this is when I first caught on to the idea. All the great teams had a system of play.
Hmm.
You know, the Bulls, we had this triangle. It's like a mystery. Here it is, 2016. I still don't know what the triangle is.
Maybe we can help him solve this mystery.
Oh, shut up.
I don't, because you we talk about it, and then if it doesn't work in year one, it takes time, Rick. And then if it doesn't work in take two, we got to find veteran players who actually...
Wait. When you say you still don't understand the triangle, there are principles about the triangle. Anybody can read the principles of the triangle.
Every offense does the same thing. It must incorporate a form of penetration, either with the pass, the dribble, or the shot. It's no different than floppy or single double or post up. Go ahead.
I would say this, though. Isn't it sort of like a continuous offense, though? Like a lot of sets have a series and then you reset. It seems to me that the triangle doesn't ever really reset. You're working out of
what's
a different...
What's the difference between the triangle and the way the Spurs play? San Antonio way.
Well,
and then...
Yeah.
Now...
You've been to floppy, though. Floppy for me is like a... is a set that you run. You look for options, A, B, C.
But out of a triangle, we're going to run reverse action off the blind pick. Everyone has a set within their system of play.
Okay.
Everyone has a system, right?
Right.
All the great teams have a system. So those old New York Knickerbockers, they had a system.
Right.
The Lakers, Showtime was a system.
Rick Adelman had his.
Rick Adelman had a system. Everyone had a play. And then when practice came, you practice the system. Oh, they're practicing the triangle. They're perfecting the triangle. Now, I didn't learn this until I played for the late Chuck Daly. I always wondered, what was the Detroit system? Like, they talked about it. What was their system, right?
Yeah.
You know, what was their system? The system was the disguise. Because I never wanted you to know exactly what I was doing. It's like, you know, I have a system, but it's an infinite amount of choices in the system.
Sure.
So the Detroit Pistons system was, it was screen roll, but it was from every angle possible.
Right.
And they didn't show that to you until game time. And if you weren't able to adjust during the game, you're going to get crushed by them.
Right.
But the system was early offense. These are terms that you hear to know what's early offense, secondary break, transition basketball. We're going to try to get as many uncontested shots as we have. That's what our offense will provide for us. I love these things. And everyone's like, yeah. The media's like, yeah. These guys are fired up tonight. Rick, you know how the guy's like, great sign, great quotes. But then you get to the game, you're like, I this guy's running, you know, isolations.
All right.
And then you hear this. They put a wrinkle in the offense.
Right.
That we didn't see. You
right.
know what I mean?
Right. Right.
So these are the things, Rick, that I have learned once I left the Bulls that Chuck Daly made me aware of.
Hmm.
The system is your disguise. The triangle is beautiful because everyone thinks they know what it is, but really no one knows what it is.
Right.
Because everyone's running the same play. Everyone's running the same floppy, green roll, you know. John Stockton didn't run the screen roll any different than we ran it, except
you know,
he was just, you know, his personnel was a little better. And he was much better at running it. But that was the Utah Jazz system.
Well, it makes me think of Rick Carlisle and what he's done. Because I remember watching him with Jermaine O'Neal. And Jermaine O'Neal would end up with the ball in the same place every time. But he'd run all this, like, misdirection. And it would look like it was a completely different play. And then you'd end up with... with Jermaine O'Neal with the ball on the right block, you know, every time. And I think I actually give him credit. It was creative, but it was like it started out completely different every time.
Once I caught on to this in the NBA, and for all the NBA fans who are listening, the ball only starts in three places. It can only start in three places. Here's the NBA offense in a nutshell. Every offense, college, high school, it can only start in three places: either the top of the key.
Yep.
Or on the wing.
Yep.
That's the offense.
Yep.
There's nothing else going on. Right. If you can't start the offense from the corner, you can't start the offense from half court, you can only start from those three places.
Right.
Now, how do you learn that? You learn on the defensively that it's my job not to let the ball to get to those places.
Right. Right.
So that
right.
they have to, so you can disrupt the other team.
Right. Right. Or so that they have to use a certain number of seconds just to get the ball there.
To that spot.
And now they got to rush everything
up. That's why Michael and Scottie were unbelievable defenders, because you could never start your offense from the wings with those guys, because they were phenomenal on the wings.
Yeah.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Now, once you know that defensively, and you know how to disrupt another team's offense, and you know where all of the angles are, now you get to these other secondary moves, you know. Are we gonna attack them in the low post, like you just said with Jermaine O'Neal?
Mm-hmm.
The one thing about the Bulls offense I thought was always incredible is that most teams, or there are very few, just the good teams, know how to play offense under 5 seconds. To me, that's an art.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. You have 24 seconds, but only the good teams know how to play or utilize their offense under 5 seconds.
Yeah. The Dallas Mavericks back in 2011 when they upset the Miami Heat.
Right. So if you watch an NBA game, how many times do you hear this? Red, everyone's scouting red, which means 5 seconds. We heard red, it was like, okay, the offense is just starting, because we knew exactly what to do under 5 seconds.
Yeah.
The bad teams, they're hollering red, and it's like,
oh, their hair's on fire. You can see it. Like, oh, no, the house is...
The players who are the top tier players in this game understand how to play under 5 seconds in less than three dribbles. And that is what separates the good teams from the great teams and the bad teams in this league.
With the time that you played in the league, I wonder, do you have, like, can even to this day, does 24 seconds, do you know how long 24 seconds is? Do you, you have an innate ability? You've played with that structure for so long on a nightly basis, multiple times. You practice it.
I you know, it's really funny. I do. And that's what makes it hard for me to watch college basketball. I think it's like 35 seconds.
Yeah.
And after about 20 seconds, I started looking around like,
getting uncomfortable.
What are these guys doing? Like, what kind of offense is this? Like, I need a shot up, right? You know what I mean? Like,
right.
And
right.
these guys are still passing. They're still like cutting. The coach is still calling a play. And I'm like, why isn't someone shot? Like, I'm telling this, I'm like screaming at this, shoot, kid, you're
something,
open. And
something's wrong. Yeah.
So it is really funny that I joke around that, you know what, I'm programmed to do everything in less than 24 seconds. But it's really funny, especially being a point guard, a former point guard. I watch games now, and the first thing I do when I walk in every arena, and you ask any point guard this, and it's just fun, just start asking guys, hey, where's the shot clock? And they'll all know where it's at. Because that's the first thing even to this day, when I walk in the arena, I look to see where the shot clock is.
Well, but they're always up on there's always one up on
Well, you got to know when in the game. You have to be able to see it up top. You got to see it from the side. I want to know where that clock is always at. I always want to know where the time and score is always at. So
are you talking about like in arenas where there's more than one? Like, not just the shot clock's up on the basket.
Yeah, there's one up above. Now they put them up like in the stand. names.
Oh, okay.
Names. And then when the game really gets disrupted, is every so often you'll see when the shot clock, something goes wrong and there's a problem with the shot clock.
Yeah,
and then they'll bring those ones and they put them on the side.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the game is all disrupted because, like, the guards aren't used to looking to the side
to find out where the clock is.
To find out where the clock is. Yeah. So it kind of disrupts your flow as a guard. And it was disrupts the flow of the game. But I am kind of programmed for 24 seconds.
Yeah, I wonder along those lines, when you first started playing, I would think that 24 seconds seemed like you were playing in a hurry. And the longer you played, the longer that 24 seconds seemed, or the slower that seemed, as opposed to the beginning, right? Because I see guys when they first come out.
I think the shot clock was like 40 seconds or 45 seconds, right? I think. And I remember my first day of practice, I thought the shot clock, the 24 shot clock, was the greatest thing ever, because that meant that I only had to play defense for like 24 seconds. I thought, this is great. I just cut my workload in half. Now, no one told me that the players were better, but you know, for me, it was just all about, God, I had to play defense for 40 seconds. I got this coach on me screaming, you know, get out. I was like, well, it takes a guy at least 7 seconds to bring it up. So now I'm at like, you know, 18 seconds or 16 seconds or something. I was like, this is great.
I can play defense for like 16, 17
seconds. So that was my initial reaction. But overall, I mean, these guys are so good, so talented, that most of the players, they only need 3 seconds really to do anything with the ball to get up a good shot.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I'm curious about with the start of the season just around the corner is the schedule comes out. And as a player, when you first get that regular season schedule, what do you do with it? Like, what do you look for? What is the first things that you want to know? And how much planning do you do once you know where you're going to play and when you're going to play?
Well, the first thing that you look for is the first big road trip.
Where is it?
Where is it?
And why? Why are you looking for the first?
Why are you looking for the road trip? Because the road trip determines how successful you can and can't be. So for instance, if I'm going on a 7-day road trip at the beginning of the season, in Chicago, for instance, every year there had to be an emphasis for us to be in great shape when we came to camp. Why? Because there was the circus that was coming in
right at
the end of every month.
Right.
And that meant we were going on a 2-week road trip. We couldn't afford to go have a slow start in Chicago. So if Chicago starts off slow and then they go on this road trip and they're less than 500, you can now they're 3-12 at the start of the season. That's awful for a young team and for a new team, because now you don't have the chemistry that you need. So at the beginning of the season, you calculate games I have to win. I have to win. So if I know my first 12 out of 16 games are at home. Okay. I got to get 10 of them. I have to win the games I know I'm supposed to win.
Right.
And then from there, I have to be able to play a minimum of 500 basketball on my long road trips, because that long road trip is going to establish the identity of who you are. So those 2 weeks, you'll find out who every team is, because at that point, now you have to play a level of basketball where it's just you versus that opponent on the road. You don't have the energy of the crowd. You're on the road, and you don't really have time to really play mistake-free basketball. And you have to get right to it. You can't be like, I can't like play bad. For the most part, you can't play bad and win on the road. If you do win a game like that, you're probably a great team if you play bad and win on the road. So I always look for the first big road trip.
Yeah.
And I always try to determine which games I knew we had to win. Like, you know, game 3 may be a game we have to win, where another team, they went 2-0. They're just happy to win it on a back-to-back.
Right.
I always tried to win every game where a team was playing on a back-to-back. That was a personal thing with me. You can't play the night before and beat me on a back-to-back. Like,
right.
You can't be better than me and outwork me too. So I always took personal pride in those games as well.
Now, being in Chicago, how often did you look at it and say, oh, Miami, Orlando in December, sweet. We're going to be out of the cold, or we're going to be like, or just socially, like, we're going to be in this great city. How much did you look at, we're going to be in LA and we're going to have a day off the day before? Like, how much did that go into it?
On the bad teams, I look forward to those trips getting out. I just wanted to, I'm in Chicago. I'm in these places. Yeah. I just want to look. Right. On the good teams,
right?
I thought it was interesting because the coach wanted to see who had the discipline to show up and play.
Yeah.
It takes 25 games, people, to find out who you are. After 25 games, you know exactly who you are. And the teams who are going to make a serious run, they have discipline. They govern themselves. They police themselves. So Miami meant nothing to me when I was on a good team. But it did mean something when I was on a bad team and we had nothing going on. It was great to be down there and be out in those really nice warm weather cities.
Actually, you know, in the media, it's the same thing. You can always tell. When I hear guys talking about, oh, you know, hey, we're going to Miami, we're going to wherever, I'm like, you're not really focused on what the deal is. Because honestly, if you're doing the beat the right way, it's not, people always look at it as a glamorous thing. Oh, you're traveling around, you're covering a team and all that stuff. Dude, you're either at the arena or you're in your hotel room or you're on the phone. That's the only way to do it.
So, you know, Miami meant nothing to me. Los Angeles meant nothing to me.
Yeah.
When we're good teams because we had discipline. And if we didn't show up, like the one thing that I appreciated about, especially when I was a young player, is I had veterans who said, hey, you can be mad at the coach, but never be mad at your teammates. Because these are your guys.
Right.
So I had a responsibility to Rick every night to show up and play. Hmm. Now, I may be mad about my playing time. Hey, man, coach didn't play me enough or such and such. I didn't get whatever. But when the game started, we played for each other. Hmm. And I had the responsibility to show up and play and be ready to play. It wasn't enough just to get to the gym. I had to be ready to play.
Right.
And that was the difference. Like, you know it when a guy is ready to play. And you know when a guy is in tune and locked in. So
you probably know when he's not.
So I never worried about whether Rick made a shot or missed a shot or made the right rotation. But as long as Rick gave me the effort and was ready, I appreciated and I respected that. And that was the respect I gave to all my teammates. And I tried to bring that wherever team I was on. And that's the professionalism that you need to have if you're going to, you know, play and perform at this level.
But speaking of which, going back to the practice question, how much did the leaders of the team, or how much was their accountability player to player in practice versus it all coming from the coach?
Well, it's a little different now. And the one thing is, my first 3 or 4 years, we traveled commercially, and we did two-a-days for the entire month. You know, and I was talking to a client yesterday who shall remain nameless. He was like, oh, man, we got two-a-days for the whole week. And I'm thinking, we did two-a-days for an entire month. I did that for like the first 4 or 5 years of my career. Now, back then, the mentality was, you get through two-a-days, and you get through that, then we'll take care of you.
What do you mean?
We made sure, meaning that our job was to help each other get through those two-a-days.
Right. Okay.
Okay. It was kind of like
player to player.
Everybody's like, going to get through, because if we can get through these two-a-days together, that's the toughness that we needed to get through a season.
Hmm.
And it was mentally. And I never forget it. And I was like, well, how am I going to do that? And I had this veteran, his name was Charles Davis. And I remember he came up to me. He's like, young fella, the coach, he can work you long, but he can't work you hard. That was like an empowering thing to me. I still remember. I was like, yeah, he can practice me for 4 hours, but I can control how hard I work in those 4 hours.
Right.
And once I took that responsibility, like, yeah, I can. He can't make me work hard. I got control of that.
Right.
And each player has control of that. And once I knew that and I saw the other guys working hard because they chose to work hard,
yeah,
it gave me like a sense of like I was in the group. Like every day I showed up to work hard and that was my choice. I didn't need the coaches to like
I got you.
Push me or tell me to work hard. It was an empowering thing.
Yeah, it wasn't not working hard or working hard. It was a matter of it felt like you were doing it because it was your choice to do it.
It was my
choice. As opposed to being made.
You hear these coaches, I got to motivate my guys. No, you can have a 5-hour practice if you choose.
Right, right.
It was my choice.
How different when you look at what Greg Popovich has done as far as the resting guys, and I thought it was funny. He's like, yeah, Tim's too smart to sit on the bench. I'm like, yeah, because he's done it for like the last 3 years. He's already done the assistant coach thing, man. He was in the huddles and all that. What do you think of the way that Greg Popovich has approached that and introduced that as opposed to that just wasn't anything that you heard coaches doing? It was almost like they had to justify their existence by working everybody long and hard.
Well, the one thing about Coach Popovich that I think everyone has that wrong. Hear me out, Rick. I think we look at it and go, oh, he's giving guys rest.
Mm-hmm.
He's not giving guys rest. What he is doing is everyone's body is different. Their workload is different.
Right.
Rick Bucher and I are going to observe the workforce of the same activity different. Rick may absorb it in his hips. I may absorb the workload in my back. Another athlete may absorb the workforce and the workload in his hamstrings. What Coach Popovich has done is not really Coach Popovich. I think Coach Popovich, to me, is really the first coach who actually listens to his medical staff. So it's always been a macho league where you push through things. You know, I play with broken fingers. They just told me to take that up, BJ. You know, there was no MRIs, whatever. You got hurt, how you feel? Put some ice on it, let's go. Coach Popovich actually listens to his medical staff and says, you know what? Hey, Timmy right now back is loading up. If we push him through this, there is a chance that maybe 20 games from now, he may be out for the season.
Right.
So let's correct him now. Correct him. See, they're just using corrective measuring that other teams aren't doing. Most teams are like, can you play? Guys can play, they go out and play. So I think Greg Popovich is the first coach who actually listens to his medical staff and says, you know what? I'm going to do this because I know that if I don't do it, there's a chance, especially as you get older, Rick, that you expose yourself to more injuries when you don't do it. So I think that's what he's doing.
I get that, and he's had older stars. I mean, there's a reason that he did it. I don't know that he always did it. But I wonder, are there examples? People would look at you and say, well, you won 3 championships. The Bulls won 3 championships. So that might have been a different way of doing things, but it worked. It was successful. Do you have any examples when you look back, whether it's yourself, your experience, what you've experienced now, where you say, you know what? If we had taken more of a Greg Popovich approach, then either I would have been healthier or this guy would have been healthier or this season wouldn't have gone the way that it did.
Well, you know, you look at the results, okay, and yeah, I was fortunate to be on 3 teams that won championships, won the last season of the game. But what people didn't see was the 6 knee surgeries, the no cartilage I have in my knees, the countless ankle injuries, the broken fingers that I had, and all those things. Do I wish I would have done a better job in taking care of my body and not trying to power through things? Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, all athletes face this. As you get older, you naturally gain weight and you do those things. So I wish I would have taken better care of myself then, but maybe I don't have those championships if I didn't push through.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? So there's a give and there's a take.
Right.
But at the same time, I was in an environment where that's all what I knew.
And that's what was expected.
It's what was expected. But that's what I expected of myself.
Yeah.
I put that pressure on myself. If I could open my eyes, I was going to play. Right. And you weren't going to tell me otherwise. Now, today, knowing what I know now, maybe it would have been a little different. You know, when I see a lot of my colleagues walking around and they've had hip replacements and knee replacements, and you know, you gain a little weight, and I go, I got to get to the gym because I'm trying to piece this thing together because I played through all of those things.
Yeah.
So, you know, Father Time doesn't pass or miss anyone. So do I wish I would have done that? Yes. Do I wish the medical, you know, maybe environment was a little different? Yes, but I think these guys have a wealth of information available to them, and they should take advantage of it. So, you know, that was then, this is now. So, but I really do, I wish I had access to the information that I have now back then when I was playing.
But let's wrap up on this on a lighter note. I want to know, when it comes to pregame rituals, preparation, the ritual that you had or that you saw a teammate have that was the best or the worst, the craziest, the ones that stood out to you that were like, I can't believe this dude, or I now looking back, I can't believe I had to do this or have this before every game. And I'm going to share you one, the one that stands out to me among guys that I covered. And there were quite a few. There were some interesting ones, but there's one in particular that stands out for me. But I want to hear yours first.
You know, there's a lot of, you know, you go to college and you go to high school and you're very impressionable. So I always thought that everyone got their rest before games. I always thought everyone would try to eat a light meal before games. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I met like Rod Strickland that...
That's the exact one I was going to use. I covered him in Washington.
I was like, you know, like, I had so much respect for Rod Strickland. So there were like games that you checked off. You're like, okay, I'm playing against Rod Strickland now. I got to really give my, I got to be ready because, you know, this dude.
He could give it to you.
He could give it. So I got to get my rest. You know what I mean? I didn't want to be that guy where I had to take on my matchup.
Yep.
And I remember I was so insulted when I saw this ball boy walking by with like, hot dogs, nacho pizza.
Yep.
And give me liberty or give me pizza pie.
I was like, where are you going with that? He was like, oh, this is Rod Strickland's pregame meal.
Yeah.
And this was like 35 minutes before the game. And
if I thought, that, yeah.
So I thought, I had this all this respect for him. And he's like, hey, man, like, this is what I do.
Yeah.
And if you ever saw Rod, the guy is like chiseled.
Yep. He's like a spree.
He is like chiseled. I mean, the guy, like, his skin's too tight for his body. And I thought, how does it? So I was like, Strick, you know how he talk.
Yeah.
What's up, son?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I was like, Strick, man, did you eat all that food, man? Do you like not respect me? You disrespect me? He was like, oh, man, I got to have some food. This is what I do, yo.
Yep.
And he would eat and he would come out and play. And I thought, that's unbelievable. Like, I had another teammate that I played with, Vernon Maxwell, the same exact thing.
Hmm.
He would eat like these brats. I mean, the worst that you can do, and go out and like, I like brats with like a diet, like a Coke with like cheese and I mean, it was like, how does this work?
Yeah,
and you know the guy wasn't sleeping, so,
right?
And he would come out and he had the energy.
Yeah,
and he would do it. But some guys, so I just learned over the years that, you know, everyone has their methods of playing. You know, I learned over the years with Michael that if I would go up to him, it was always funny. You know, you have routines, like, you know, after like, you know, 200 games or so, you know, you have your space and routine.
Yeah.
And I would look at Rick. Rick would look at me like, yeah, I'm ready to go. You ready to go? Yeah, I'm ready to go. And every game, I would like, M, you ready? I would just say, M, you know, you ready? And M would say, oh man, my ankle's hurting tonight. And we'd be like, yeah, he's hurt. Now, whenever he was hurt, he was unreal. We just never wanted to hear when he was like, I'm good. Like the guy would be on the training table. He got stem all on him, his wrist.
Right.
Whenever he was injured, that's when he was going to get like 55. Like, hey man, what's wrong with him? Oh man, his back. He couldn't even walk. And then you were like, okay, yeah, we good. Everybody else was like, Michael didn't. All the reporters would be like, Michael Jordan may not play tonight. We're
right.
Like, okay, yeah, he good. He couldn't warm up. His wrist is bad. His back is bad. You know, he's got a crook in his neck.
Yeah.
And then he would somehow go. It was when he came to the gym and he was feeling good.
Yeah.
And we never wanted him to get sleep.
So I saw, to wrap up, I saw firsthand the Rod Strickland eating the stuff. And there was one time, and the reason that he would stay chiseled and the reason it wouldn't bother him is because he'd throw all that up like in the first quarter. Like at some point, and in fact, there was a guy that would have like a towel for him. He would come back to the sometime in the first quarter and he'd throw up into a towel, and then you'd see like one of the ball boys or whatever taking the towel away. This happened almost every game. And the one thing about Rod is he never received, I thought, the recognition he deserved. He was never an all-star, never acknowledged for the kind of player he was. And the Wizards tried one time. They were going to, I think he won the assists award or whatever. And they wanted to have a ceremony before the game. And they couldn't. And I don't know whether it was the nerves or whatever, but he was back throwing up his usual pregame meal. And so Wes Unseld had to kind of like, he was out there ready to like present him a plaque or do whatever. And they just kind of had to quickly, okay, let's just go on with the game. Because we don't, they were there to honor Rod. There's no Rod. And then right before tip off, he comes running out and he's like, you know, putting in a breath mint and getting ready to play the game.
This guy, Rod, Rod Strickland was like one of those guys that everyone in the league, he had the players' respect. Like all the players knew, like, who you think is the best? Everyone would say Rod Strickland. Everyone knew. I mean, Rod, like, I don't know how the guy played. He'd tape all his fingers up. How did he dribble with all this tape? And he would do that. And as we said, his lay game was incredible. His layup game was like crazy because you knew he wasn't going to shoot a jump shot, and he still got to the basket.
Right. And
got by.
And he wasn't like going high either.
No, he was
just skating along the floor, and the ball was coming up off.
Everybody who played in that era was like, his game was nice.
Yeah.
But there was another player that no one talks about that, to me, I think might have been the greatest talent that I've seen in the NBA. Was Michael Ray Richardson, the Sugar Man.
Huh.
I've never seen a player to this day that was attacked on offense, but he did that on defense as well. I never saw a player attack Michael Jordan like Sugar Man.
Really?
Now, he did it for such a short window that no one talks about it, but this guy, Michael Ray Richardson, when you ask Rick, when we around all the old timers, especially All-Star Weekend, start asking Isaiah Thomas and Magic Johnson, ask him about the Sugar Man. They all, like, it's one of those things like, yeah, the Sugar Man was the real deal, but we ain't gonna talk about it. No, seriously, it's like one of those things that no one really talks about.
Yeah.
But the Sugar Man,
yeah.
I saw him, I played against this guy one time, Rick, and I thought he might've been one of the greatest players I've ever seen. And to this day, but he was such short-lived and documented his off the court problems, but an incredible, incredible player. And there's a lot of players that play in the NBA that the players, it's kind of a whisper. Yeah, man. And Strickland was one of those guys that everyone would whisper when the cameras were off. Hey, man, Strick is the real deal. But this guy, Michael Ray Richardson, I felt the same way about him.
Cool. All right. Well, but by the next time that we do our podcast, we will have actual exhibition games played. We'll see some people on the floor. And we'll have a read, at least an early read, on some of the teams that are out there. And I may want to get into with you, like, the rosters out there, the best and the worst rosters, especially the worst rosters. Like, the teams right now, everybody's full of hope, rainbows, and puppies, right?
I'm going to the analytics, Rick. I'm going to the analytics.
And you just look at it and you go, oh, that team right there, they ain't got a chance in hell.
It's all about the
analytics.
Season
ain't started yet.
Let's look at the analytics. Let's look at the numbers.
We will look at it all. And we'll do it again next week. BJ, thanks a lot. You've been listening to the BJ and Bucher podcast on The Cycle. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.